Iran's leader says the current U.S. administration is no different from the previous one, since it makes the same demands over Tehran's nuclear program. The U.S. launches a drone strike against what it calls a Daesh planner in Afghanistan's Nangarhar province and issues a fresh security warning. And China slams as provocative the transit of a U.S. guided missile destroyer and a Coast Guard cutter through the Taiwan Strait. And welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned into World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is no different from its predecessor, run by Donald Trump. Ayatollah Khamenei said the only difference between Biden and Trump is that each used a different set of words to achieve their goals over Iran's nuclear program. Trump withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 Iran nuclear deal 3 years ago and restored sanctions in order to renegotiate it for, quote, a better one. Biden has voiced willingness to rejoin the multilateral agreement. Ayatollah Khamenei noted that the U.S. has the nerve to behave in a way as if it was Iran which walked away from the nuclear deal. He also blasted France, Britain, and Germany for failing to live up to their commitments under the deal. The leader said the trio's obstructionism in implementing the accord is no less than that of the U.S. Well, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has condemned U.S. President Joe Biden for what he called illegally threatening the Islamic Republic. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani said Biden's emphasis on using other options with regard to Iran's nuclear program establishes Tehran's right to reciprocate. The reaction followed a meeting between Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett at the White House. During the meeting, Biden said he was putting diplomacy first on Iran's nuclear issue, but added he would be prepared to turn to other options. Biden's threat of unspecified options came after Israel's Minister of Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, accused Iran of seeking a nuclear weapon. Gantz said military action should be considered as Plan B to prevent Tehran from accessing a nuclear warhead. Iran has repeatedly dismissed such accusations, especially from Israel, that itself is in the possession of hundreds of nukes. And now to Iraq, to the capital Baghdad, which is hosting a regional summit on cooperation and partnership. A number of top regional and international officials, including the French president and Iranian foreign minister, are in attendance. The participants have pledged support for Iraq and emphasize the significance of peace and stability there. Iraqi Prime Minister Mostafa al-Khademi told the summit that Baghdad will not allow Iraq to become a base for attacking neighboring countries. Addressing the summit, the Iranian foreign minister said his country has always supported Iraq.
Iraq today plays a very significant role in all the efforts and constructive efforts because the Islamic Republic of Iran has been from the first countries in the region which admitted and declared the new Iraq and had given its support to the political institutions in this country. Said the Islamic Republic of Iran has rapidly hurried to give its hand of support to their brothers in Iraq to the level of fighting terrorism and has not stopped at any sort of efforts in this regard.
Amir Abdullahian also stressed that peace is necessary for dialogue and regional security. The Iranian top diplomat expressed hope that regional countries would realize that peace will not be achieved in the absence of mutual trust. He blamed the U.S. for the chaos in the region, saying that Washington committed a crime by targeting commanders such as General Qasem Soleimani, who fought terrorists. Amir Abdullahian expressed regret over Syria's absence at the summit. He emphasized that security will be ensured through the participation of all neighboring states. Now, the U.S. military says it has carried out a drone strike against a Daesh planner in eastern Afghanistan. The military said the strike took place in Nangarhar province. It said initial indications are that the target was killed. The drone strike took place early on Saturday, 2 days after a bomb attack hit the Kabul airport. The attack was claimed by the Daesh terror group. According to the U.S. media, it killed at least 180 people, including 13 U.S. service members. The attack was the deadliest for American forces in Afghanistan in over a decade. It took place as Afghans and foreign nationals were awaiting evacuation 2 weeks after the Taliban took over of Kabul. Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in the Afghan capital, Kabul, has issued a fresh warning for Americans to avoid traveling to the city's airport, citing security threats. U.S. citizens have also been asked to leave the surrounding areas of the airport immediately. The warning came hours after the Pentagon said the evacuation process continued to face, quote, specific, credible threats. Now, that followed Thursday's deadly attack outside of the Kabul airport. The attack hampered the evacuation process of foreign nationals and forces ahead of the August 31st deadline. However, a Western official has said the evacuation of civilians is underway at a very fast pace to meet the deadline. More than 5,000 people remain inside the airport awaiting evacuation, while some Western countries, including Spain and France, have already ended their operations. We were earlier joined by a correspondent in Afghanistan, Amin Alami, who gave us the latest on the prevailing chaos at Kabul International Airport.
Well, the situation in the airport is chaotic so far, and thousands of people are still stationed very close to Kabul International Airport, despite the U.S. embassy, U.S. officials and U.K. officials had already warned of possible terrorist attacks by Daesh members in Kabul International Airport. However, the Pentagon also said that it's going to continue the evacuation process in order to fully evacuate all of U.S. citizens and those who have had worked with them over the past 20 years. In the meantime, some other countries have insisted that the evacuation process has been ended, and they are not willing to continue such a process from Kabul International Airport. However, the Taliban blamed the U.S. for failing to protect protect civilians who had gathered close to the eastern entrance gate of Kabul International Airport. Zabihullah Mujahid said, who is the spokesperson of Taliban, said that it was the failure of U.S. military forces that Daesh terrorists made their way to the entrance gate of Kabul International Airport and blown up themselves.
The complicated saga of the U.S.'s withdrawal from Afghanistan continues to unfold. Most recently, a bomb attack hit the crowd outside the Kabul International Airport, killing U.S. servicemen and Afghans. The scenes of death and confusion in Kabul have put the outcome of the 20-year war in Afghanistan in perspective, especially U.S.'s so-called war on terror.
On Thursday, the Afghan capital Kabul became the scene of carnage. Scores of people were killed after two bombs exploded in the crowd outside the international Kabul airport.
The Pentagon, however, stated there was only one bomb attack.
Over a dozen U.S. troops were confirmed to have been killed in the attack. The Daesh terror group claimed responsibility. The blast came as hundreds of people were rushing to leave the Afghan capital prior to the August 31st deadline set by U.S. President Joe Biden to fully withdraw troops from the country. Intelligence reports had warned about the possibility of attacks on the airport by an offshoot of the Daesh terrorist group, which has fought against both foreign forces and the Taliban in Afghanistan since its formation in 2015. The U.S. president vowed revenge on the perpetrators, saying the evacuation efforts will continue regardless.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this: we will not forgive.
We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Some, however, are questioning why the U.S. chose to withdraw from this Central Asian country at this point, and if it can continue its operations in Afghanistan without having a military base there.
I think that there are a couple of reasons. First of all, they might not have thought it was important. Secondly, they were probably preoccupied with getting out. Thirdly, I'm not sure that their intelligence is as good as they say. And I think that from their point of view, they had degraded Al-Qaeda to the point that they were satisfied with. They were not focused on Afghanistan.
The outcome of the United States' longest war has also raised questions about the success of foreign military presence in the country.
Both the West and Afghanistan have paid a heavy price for the invasion of the Central Asian country. Since the war began in 2001, over 38,000 civilians have been killed, including over 2,400 U.S. military personnel. The war has proven to be quite costly also, with trillions of dollars being spent. In the meantime, all that seems to have been for nothing, as the situation in Afghanistan is taking a turn to how it used to be before the invasion 20 years ago.
More than 111,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept to power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31st deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out the Al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. He has noted that the aim of the war has never been nation-building, a statement in contrast to what U.S. officials used to say when the war began.
But the fundamental issue is that in many, many cases, it's not only Afghanistan, it's been Syria, it's been Iraq, it has been countries in Africa. We've intervened in South America. Basically, without any willingness on the United States' part to recognize the sovereignty of other countries. So unless we begin to deal with that, I don't think we're going to be particularly effective in dealing with groups that we conceive to be terrorists.
Over the past 20 years, the U.S. and its NATO allies maintained a military presence in Afghanistan with the stated aim of fighting terrorists. The recent incident at the Kabul airport was a clear indication that the mission was not accomplished.
China has called provocative the transit of a U.S. warship through the Taiwan Strait. In a statement, China's defense ministry said the U.S.'s frequent provocative moves show that it is the biggest destroyer of peace and stability and the biggest cause of security risks in the region. A U.S.-guided missile destroyer and a Coast Guard cutter sailed through the Taiwan Strait on Friday, a week after China held military drills near that area. The U.S. Navy claims the American vessels transited the waters legally, adding that Washington is committed to a free and open Indo-Pacific. China considers Taiwan an inseparable part of its territory, but the island has long been a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington. U.S. intelligence services say they cannot figure out the mystery of the true origins of the novel coronavirus without China's help. In a declassified report, the agency said that they need more information to reach a conclusive assessment of the origins of COVID-19. They accused China of refusing to share key data over the issue. The virus emerged in China's Wuhan in 2019 and has so far killed 4.6 million people worldwide. The World Health Organization has already rejected the theory that the first human infection with COVID-19 was likely due to a laboratory leak. China's embassy in Washington hit back at the report, saying the U.S. is going down the wrong path of, quote, political manipulation. The embassy said the intelligence community's report is only for scapegoating China. Meanwhile, Iran has reported more than 600 new coronavirus deaths, pushing its total number of fatalities to nearly 106,000. Health officials also registered over 26,000 new infections over the past day. The overall caseload is standing at nearly 4.9 million. The highly contagious Delta variant is blamed for the rise in both cases and deaths. Officials have tried to accelerate mass vaccinations to curb the deadly virus. Some 18 million Iranians have received the first dose of the jab, and more than 7 million have been fully vaccinated. Well, the Italian government's plan to extend COVID green pass requirement to all key workers and state employees is causing a stir. Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass. Max Giavilli brings us more from Rome.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its green pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
La Sicilia.
Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti.
That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the green pass is the way to go.
Basta queste scuse.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the green pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Millions of Americans around the country face the prospect of losing their homes after the Supreme Court on Thursday, 26th of August, rejected the Biden administration's latest federal moratorium on evictions, a decision that poses a new and unwelcome problem for a White House already grappling with domestic and international challenges. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Rappaport, Sophie Kasikov, and Connor Doherty. The piece is titled, Supreme Court's Decision Opens Doors to Millions of Evictions. Stay with us for more. Millions of Americans around the country face the prospect of losing their homes after the Supreme Court on Thursday, 26th of August, rejected the Biden administration's latest federal moratorium on evictions, a decision that poses a new and unwelcome problem for a White House already grappling with domestic and international challenges. The court's ruling has once again thrust President Joe Biden into the middle of a fight to help prevent people from being evicted as the Delta variant of the coronavirus surges, and as Democrats remain unable to muster enough votes to pass a new ban on evictions. Absent legislation, there are few easy fixes. The administration is struggling to speed the flow of billions of dollars in federal funding to people who are behind in rent because of economic hardship associated with the coronavirus pandemic. The scramble to find a solution follows the 8-page majority opinion the Supreme Court issued on Thursday evening, 26th of August, that said the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, had exceeded its authority in acting to prevent landlords from evicting tenants during a public health crisis. No one knows exactly how many tenants are in jeopardy, but the Census Bureau reported this week that more than 1 million people were very likely to face eviction for non-payment of rent over the next 2 months, with millions more behind on rent payments and in arrears. With no legal avenues remaining to take action on its own, the Biden administration issued a plea to state and local officials on Friday, 27th of August, to do more to help. In a letter, top cabinet members urged governors, mayors, county executives, and judges and administrators to extend local eviction moratoriums. The letter from Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, Marcia L. Fudge, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Attorney General Merrick Garland also asked them to enact policies that would require landlords to apply for federal aid before enforcing evictions, and recommended that evictions be delayed whilst rental aid applications were pending. The troubles facing the Biden administration's $46.5 billion emergency rental assistance program were clear this week, when Treasury Department figures showed that 89% of the money had yet to be distributed by state and local governments. Just $1.7 billion made it to tenants or landlords in July, as states and cities continue to grapple with how to streamline the application processes. With the court's decision looming, the Treasury Department rolled out changes to the program on Wednesday, including additional attempts to absolve local governments of federal punishment if they provided money to those who do not actually need help. The agency issued a directive to local officials that they allow tenants to use self-reported financial information on aid applications as a first rather than a last resort, while giving states permission to send bulk payments to landlords and utility companies in anticipation of federal payouts to tenants. The Supreme Court's ruling divided lawmakers along party lines on Friday, 27th of August, with Republicans applauding the decision and Democrats demanding legislative action to address a looming eviction crisis. A group of progressive House Democrats wrote a letter to Speaker Nancy Pelosi and to Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader in the Senate, calling on congressional leaders to include an extended moratorium that would last through the end of the pandemic in upcoming legislation. An effort by House Democrats to extend the eviction ban failed in July. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, said on Friday, 27th of August, that President Biden would welcome congressional action. Barring that, she said the White House was focused on finding other ways to ease the burden on tenants by encouraging the delay of evictions and getting financial assistance out the door more quickly. A senior White House official said there were no long-shot measures that the administration was waiting to deploy. It will continue to see if agencies like HUD can do more to stall evictions, and it will accelerate efforts to get states to pump out relief money faster. The wave of evictions is coming at a fragile juncture for the economic recovery, and as the fiscal support that Congress approved during the initial stages of the pandemic is winding down. The effect on tenants will vary tremendously from state to state and from city to city, said Diane Yentl, the president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. In some states like California, New Jersey, and Virginia, tenants will temporarily be allowed to remain in their homes thanks to statewide protections. In a statement on Friday, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York derided the Supreme Court's decision as appalling and insensitive. The state is considering calling a special session of the state legislature to protect residents from eviction. But in other states, especially where evictions have already been progressing through the courts of law, people could lose their homes swiftly. The eviction process can take anywhere from a matter of days in some states to weeks or months in other states. But Ms. Yentl said she expected that many tenants would leave their homes before undergoing a formal eviction process in an effort to avoid landing an eviction on their record, which would make it harder to find housing in the future. For tenants in many states, it has been clear for months that they're on their own. Judges in Texas have been serving evictions since last March, when the state Supreme Court refused to extend an order that gave judges the authority to enforce the CDC moratorium. After a federal district court in Tennessee found that the moratorium was unlawful in July, judges in parts of Tennessee and Ohio have allowed eviction proceedings to continue as normal. Elsewhere, landlords have been able to skirt the moratorium by citing reasons other than non-payment of rent as justification for eviction. The struggle to get assistance to tenants is in many ways just an illustration of a fact that has been true for several decades. The United States has never had or tried to build a national-level system to keep its citizens secure in their homes. Now it is trying to establish one on the fly during a pandemic, with predictable results. While rental aid is now flowing much faster, since June, California has more than quadrupled its pace of payments, many of the country's most vulnerable tenants live in informal housing arrangements like illegal garage conversions or packed apartments with one leaseholder, making it difficult for aid programs that often require lease agreements to reach. Across the country, the news of the moratorium ending filled struggling tenants with fear. Brian Fitzpatrick, a 59-year-old, fell behind on the monthly rent of $550 for his one-bedroom apartment in St. Louis, Missouri, after his unemployment benefit expired and he was unable to return to work after a fall left him with broken ribs. He applied for rental assistance but said he had yet to receive a response. You could be sitting here thinking everything is good, and then you got the sheriff at the door talking about, you got to get out, he said.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for joining us here on The Key and IRIB English Radio. We would like to offer our condolences on the sacred month of Muharram, which is the month in which Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred. Today we're going to be speaking about one of the characteristics of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and that is the respect that Imam Hussein had was shown by the three caliphs. Imam Hussein is the third Imam of the Shias. However, he is also respected by the other sects within Islam, and he was also shown a great deal of respect by the first three caliphs. And this makes his the actions of Yazid and his explicit attack on Imam Hussein and his family even worse, because it also goes against the conduct of the first three caliphs, which is unanimously agreed as being something binding upon all Muslims, especially for the other Muslims as well, besides Shias. In the time of the first three caliphs, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was respected by them. The first three caliphs also they bared and they had patience with the objections of Imam Hussein to their political actions. By way of example, we can mention a story which has been related in some of the books of traditions of the Shias and the Ahlul Bayt. This tradition says that one day Umar was sitting on the minbar and he was giving a sermon. Imam Hussein alayhi salam was a relatively young child at this time. When Imam Hussein saw this, he told Umar to get off my father's pulpit, and go and sit on your own father's pulpit. Upon hearing this, Umar was amused at hearing this and said, "Well, my father doesn't have a pulpit." He then took Imam Hussein and sat him beside himself and showed his respect and his love to him. In the beginning of the caliphate of Abu Bakr, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was 7 years old. During the caliphate of Umar, he was 9 years old. And in the beginning of the caliphate of Osman, he had arrived at 19 years of age. So altogether, this era in his blessed life took approximately 25 years. This makes the actions of Yazid and his outright and explicit opposition to Imam Hussein, it makes it something even worse because it goes against this conduct. So we believe that Imam Hussein is a personality who is respected by all Muslims, and aside from that, he is given a special place within Shiite Islam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the status and honor of Imam Hussein in the eyes of the first three caliphs. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Biden administration's weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Miriam Benjamin and Ariel Gold, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, Why is Biden selling weapons to a country that helped make Yemen a hell hole? Stay tuned for more. The Biden administration's recent announcement giving a green light to a massive $23 billion weapons sales to the United Arab Emirates makes a mockery of its commitment to put human rights at the forefront of its foreign policy. The Emirates' disastrous roles in Yemen and Libya, along with its vicious human rights record at home, should disqualify it from acquiring advanced weapons. The deal was negotiated under the Trump administration and came to light less than a week after Donald Trump announced the normalization of relations between the Zionist regime and the UAE, known as the Abraham Accords. While the public was diverted with Trump's supposedly brilliant peace initiative, the secret clause that sweetened the deal was leaked. The U.S. would sell billions of dollars of weapons to the Persian Gulf state, 50 F-35 fighter jets, 18 Reaper drones and various missiles, bombs, and munitions. The UAE and the Zionist regime have never been at war and had maintained unofficial ties for years, but the peace accord allowed the Trump administration to circumvent a policy that requires the United States to guarantee the Israeli regime's military superiority in the region. The Zionist regime's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu initially feigned outrage that another West Asian country besides the regime would possess the high-tech F-35, but it was soon revealed that the Prime Minister had been in the know from the start and had approved the deal with his own caveat. The Israeli regime would get additional U.S. weapons to balance those going to the UAE. Congressional opponents of the arms deal responded by introducing a bipartisan resolution of disapproval to block the sale. Surprisingly, hawkish Senator Bob Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, led the resolution with Senators Chris Murphy and Ron Paul. They cited concerns about the timing as a rushed end run around Congress, the UAE's troubling involvement in Yemen and Libya. Though their legislation was voted down when Joe Biden came into office, the State Department put this sale, as well as a weapons deal Trump had negotiated with Saudi Arabia, on hold. Human rights groups were encouraged that the Biden review might lead to a quashing of the deal, but apparently, geopolitical pressures, the hawks in the administration, and pressure from the weapons lobby have won the day. The companies that stand to gain hefty profits from this sale include Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Atomics, and Northrop Grumman. Lockheed Martin will get $10.4 billion selling 50 of its F-35s. According to the New York Times, Raytheon, the biggest supplier of the bombs, lobbied the Trump administration for the deal. Trump's Secretary of Defense Mike Esper was a lobbyist for Raytheon, and Biden's Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is a former Raytheon board member. The UAE's role in Yemen should have been enough to quash the deal. For the past 6 years, the U.S.-supported coalition led by Saudi Arabia has been waging a war in Yemen so brutal that, according to David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, this war-torn nation is hell on earth, where one Yemeni child dies every 75 seconds. In 2017, Human Rights Watch and Associated Press accused the UAE of operating secret prisons in Yemen where prisoners were subjected to horrific forms of torture. Former inmates described cramped conditions covered in feces, being beaten, sexually assaulted, and trussed up on a grill. "We could hear the screams," said a former detainee held for 6 months at the Ryan airport. "The entire place is gripped by fear. Almost everyone is sick. The rest are near death. Anyone who complains heads directly to the torture chamber," said one former detainee. In addition to its direct involvement, the UAE supported local proxies, around 90,000 fighters, providing them with direct training, capacity building, logistic assistance, and salaries. It also brought in mercenaries from as far away as Colombia, and weapons sold to the UAE ended up in the hands of Al-Qaeda terrorists inside Yemen. Complaints have been filed in the courts in the UK and the US, alleging that UAE mercenaries in Yemen committed human rights abuses and war crimes. They also allege that the UAE joined the Saudis in enforcing a naval blockade that has kept fuel, food, and medicines from people in need, committing over 30 fighter jets to carry out airstrikes and naval ships to enforce the coalition's blockade. Anxious to get out of a losing war that has been so bad for its image, the Emirates held a ceremony on February 9, 2020, to mark the end of their involvement in the Yemeni war, moving from a military-first strategy to a peace-first strategy. But humanitarian groups on the ground tell us that the UAE maintains a presence in Saqqarah, Mokalla, and a small presence in Yemen. In addition, it offers financial and military support to a variety of armed groups and political movements that have had a destabilizing influence throughout the country, particularly in the south. Another strike against Israel is that it is fueling the West Asia arms race. While the UAE is set to become the first Arab state to acquire F-35s, it will not be the last. Qatar has already asked to purchase them, and Saudi Arabia will likely follow. The Israeli regime is expecting additional arms beyond the $3.8 billion they already receive annually from the U.S. in military assistance. A final reason is to oppose the deal is the UAE domestic situation. Prince Mohammed bin Zayed is a shrewd West Asian dictator who uses his country's military and financial resources to thwart moves toward democracy and respect for human rights under the guise of fighting terrorism. The UAE restricts freedom of expression and silences dissent. According to Amnesty International, in 2020, despite the COVID-19 pandemic, the UAE continued to detain dozens of prisoners of conscience, including prominent human rights defender Ahmed Mansour. The government keeps opponents under arbitrary detention, and a number of prisoners remain incarcerated despite having completed their sentences. On April 15, 2021, a cross-party coalition of European parliamentarians condemned the systematic crackdown on freedom of speech and expression and called for the release of all prisoners of conscience and an end to torture and ill treatment of these prisoners and the protection of prisoners' families from collective punishment. Another group subject to all kinds of abuses are the millions of migrants who work in Emirates under the kafala system, a type of visa sponsorship system which deprives workers of basic rights. Faced with domestic crises that include a pandemic, a battered economy, and exploding racial tensions, President Biden understands the need to focus his attention on domestic issues and wind down U.S. military entanglements from the past two decades. His recent announcement that U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan by September 11, 2021 reflects this. A $23 billion weapons sales to the UAE is a disastrous move in the Biden administration. It puts the U.S. squarely on the side of a serial human rights abuser and inflames a region already awash with way too many weapons. A new round of legislation by Senators Menendez and Feinstein is being introduced to put checks on the sale of F-35s, but it is the entire sale that must be questioned. If Biden refuses to put domestic and human rights concerns ahead of the profits of weapons manufacturers, then Congress must step and pass legislation to stop it. You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيت الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. In this the month of Muharram, one of the things that, you know, the martyrdom and the event of Ashura and Karbala is not something that, you know, is new or something that happened over time. It was something that has been or according to some narrations, had been written. And a group of people, from the very beginning, according to the tradition that we will mention today, that we will share with our dear listeners, you know, have always had this love, this attraction, this desire for Imam al-Hussein alayhi wassalam. And especially after that event, there is a greater desire and a greater attraction towards the Imam alayhi salam because of that event and because of the tragedy of that particular event. So we have this tradition that has been mentioned by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. It's a very famous tradition, and I'm sure most of you may have heard it before. That says, surely, inna li qatl al-Husayn, that surely, definitely, for the killing and the slaughter of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, there is a what? Harara. There is a heat, there is a flame. There is this burning desire. But where? Fi qulub al-mu'mineen, in the hearts of the believers. Now here, obviously, heart is not just this physical heart that we have. Heart is our soul, our nafs. Go further, it is our essence. That in our very essence, there is this fire and flame for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, for the mu'mineen, for the believers, for any person who believes in the kalima of La ilaha illallah Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. This is important to understand, that every single person who claims to be a Muslim, there should be this fire. Or rather, a fire in the heart of a person indicates that he is a Muslim. And this fire will never ever subside, will never calm down, will never cool. La tubradu abada. It will never cool down. It will never be extinguished. This is what Imam al-Hussein alayhi wasalam is. That in the month of Muharram, this flame that is within our very essence, at times during the year, you know, it goes low. It is during this month where it is, you know, reignited, or the flame is, you know, kind of increased. And then we see that, no, this is what I need to do. Imam al-Hussein alayhi wasalam did not do what he did just for the sake of, you know, us to cry. Yes, all of this is very important. But in order for us to get closer to Allah subhanahu, to achieve the goal by which we were created, that is to become the Khalifatullah fil ard, to become the true representatives of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth. And it is that flame that will assist us in doing so. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to assist us in this regard and make us truly use the month of Muharram in the way it is meant to be used. Inshallah, until the next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This spotlight.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.